Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning wrap-up of Utah news featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW. Today on the program, lawmakers ponder importing water from the Pacific Ocean to rescue the Great Salt Lake. Northern Utah sees its worst dust storms in a decade, but the drying up lake isn't to blame yet. And new details emerge about the Utah Inland Port, including a snag for a major component of the project. Plus, a small southern Utah town aims to create a big sports complex on BLM land. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley. And welcome, Brian. Glad you're with us on the Zoom.
Yeah. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. And here in studio, Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Welcome to you, Robert. And thanks for being here.
Hey, good to be here.
And a little bit later on the show, we will hear from Tribune Water and Lands reporter Leah Larson. Stick around for that. Tweet your comments to @KCPW if you'd like to weigh in on what we're covering today. We can't take your calls today. Let's begin with what I think is the most sort of bizarre news story that I read this week, or at least it feels kind of bizarre. Brian Maffley, an idea that is being mulled over by a legislative commission to import water from a long ways away, the Pacific Ocean, for the Great Salt Lake. Is that a serious proposal?
Apparently it is, Roger. It came up in the interim legislative sessions last week or this week at the Water Development Commission, where a couple lawmakers, namely Senator Hankins and Representative Albrecht, convinced the other commission to put this pipeline idea on their list of things to study. So they will be taking a look at it. But let's be clear, there's no proposal out there right now to build such a pipeline. And the fact of the matter is, it has pretty much a 0% chance of ever getting built.
I mean, this would be really expensive. And I also wonder about the logistics. Are there laws governing the use of seawater, of moving it so far as well, that would maybe get in the way? I don't know the answer to that question.
That's a good question. I mean, this is the first anyone has ever heard about this idea for the Great Salt Lake. And as Senator Hankins did point out, that elsewhere in the world, these kind of proposals are being kicked around, especially in Israel, where the Dead Sea is kind of in a similar situation as the Great Salt Lake. They're both saline terminal lakes. However, the Dead Sea is a lot closer to the Mediterranean than the Great Salt Lake is to the Pacific Ocean. For this project to happen, you'd have to build a very large pipeline, at least 700 miles over, various mountain ranges, crossing California and Nevada. Neither of those states, I would imagine, would be too keen on such a pipeline being run across their states. And then you have an intake facility on the California coast somewhere.
The water is also a different salinity. Does that make a difference?
And then you have the environmental impacts to the Great Salt Lake, where normally the water flowing into the lake is fresh water from the Bear River, the Weber. This would be salt water. And so, as advocates for the lake have pointed out, is, the lake is already suffering from elevated salt content because it's, as we all know, it's evaporating, it's shrinking, it's less than half the size it is historically. That means the salinity's elevated. So now we're going to put, more salt into that system than it normally would receive.
Yeah, you spoke with Linda Freitas from Friends of Great Salt Lake, and she talked also about the sort of scar on the landscape of putting a pipeline with water running all the way from the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, and I'm really curious how you get a pipeline that would carry, several hundred thousand acre feet of water a year over the Sierra Nevada. We're talking a 7,000-8,000 foot mountain range.
And then cutting across the Great Basin.
It kind of speaks to the wishful thinking that kind of pervades the Utah legislature at times, where you know, we can kind of, there's thought we can kind of build our way out of a crisis of our own making, when maybe we should look at what is the cause of the shrinking Great Salt Lake. Well, it's water diversions upstream from the lake. I think the solution is pretty obvious, that we need to let more water, reach the lake naturally.
Is that lower hanging fruit, Brian? I guess is what I mean. Is it, isn't,
well, yeah, this fruit is at the top of the tree, man. It'll be very hard to reach.
Okay. What about, is there some value though? Maybe this is a question for Robert Gerke, who I will bring in, the news columnist. Is there some value, Robert, in the fact that wild ideas are being considered? Do you know what I mean? It shows a willingness to go to extremes to rescue the lake by the state, by lawmakers.
No, you know, you're being much too kind, because they're embracing or exploring these wild ideas without looking at the simple solution, which is conservation, upstream use, and part of it deals with agriculture, which they're not going to touch. It's sort of the third rail of Utah politics, I guess. But I guess they can explore it. I don't think that, you know, it's going to go very far. As Brian mentioned, pumping water up 8,000 feet to have it flow back down across hundreds of miles. You've got this whole issue with sharks ending up in the lake. No, I'm kidding. It's just preposterous. I guess they have to exhaust every option before they choose the right one, which is, you know, making hard decisions, politically difficult decisions about how to preserve the lake and its water.
Later on in the show, we're going to hear from Leah Larson, and she talks about dust events. This has been a bad year already for dust storms. So far, the lake is not the source, or it seems that it's not the source of that dust. But when it comes to that point, airborne arsenic-laced dust, that could really put a damper on living here. And so getting water on the lake is critical. Go ahead.
Before we move on, I just want to – and think about the economics of this pipeline, too. I mean, the only comparison I can think of is we have oil pipelines, right, which are which we have because oil sells for $70 a barrel. If we're selling water for $70 a barrel, we have a huge economic problem here in Utah. And so, you know, to make it economical, you're going to have to be paying a lot for water. We're not going to keep having this cheap water. And so why don't we do something to avoid getting to that point? I mean, it's just it's kind of mind-boggling. But, you know, I did have a legislator bring this up to me about a month ago. I thought he was joking. But they think this will prevent the oceans from rising if we can pump it all out here. So maybe there's two birds with one stone aspect to it.
Brian Maffley, I know you talked – I'm just wondering if there's anything else you want to add on this story. I know you talked about what else this commission is looking at. There's some other wild ideas out there. But what other sorts of what other sorts of projects?
Well, the one I really liked came from Representative Kevin Stratton, where he talked about looking at the idea of using – effluent from septic systems as a water source. I don't know about you, but I think I'd rather not be, you know, sticking a straw into that kind of water. That actually might have some really good merit to it. The other things have to do with just, you know, optimizing the way agriculture uses water. Just, it's more kind of the commonsensical kind of things. One thing they are going to re-examine, this has been kicked around before, is running a pipeline from the Green River to help, Utah access its alleged share of the Colorado River. But that's an old idea. I think they were just, you know, just doing their due diligence on that idea as a way of just checking a box. So I don't think there's a serious proposal to develop a pipeline like that.
Got it.
But in general, everything on that list struck me as pretty commonsensical, like the kind of things that need to be done.
One really good idea that I think came out of this was Senator Dan McKay's talking about changing the law so you know, water districts can't use property tax to subsidize their water, because what we've had in this state for too long is we've had people not paying the full value of their water because it's all subsidized by property tax. And so, you know, if you don't start paying the cost, you don't have an incentive to conserve. And so I think that's an idea that's long overdue and hopefully will yield some conservation benefits.
All right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Brian.
Roger. Yeah. Robert is absolutely right on that one. And one of the other ideas we're going to study is to basically require metering on residential water users in rural Utah. So currently, a lot of water users don't, you know, they pay a flat rate for their water, so they have zero incentive to, you know, minimize how much they use.
Right.
And it just seems like before we start kicking around these ideas for extremely expensive water projects, we really need to get a handle on how much water we use as, you know, at the residential level. And at the agricultural level too, so we can, you know, just make better decisions. Mm-hmm. So I was actually kind of surprised that there are that many water users who are unmetered in the rural parts of the state. Yeah, we know it's a big issue up here in northern Utah with so-called secondary water, and the state now is investing heavily to put meters on those secondary systems. There's, you know, thousands of them in Weber and Davis counties. You know, studies have shown that just by metering water, not even charging more for it, but just metering it and showing people how much they're using really goes a long way to promote conservation.
Isn't the metering a long ways, a kind of a far ways down the road, though? I mean, they did pass a law to do metering, but isn't it going to take something like a few decades?
I don't think so. I mean, they have hundreds of millions of dollars of federal money right now that they're investing in the secondary water metering program.
Okay.
However, you know, one of the things we learned at the interim sessions was, you know, the cost of metering a system now is a lot more than they had expected. Whereas, you know, last year it was, they talked about it being, you know, $1,000 to $1,500 connect per connection. Now they're talking, you know, almost $3,000 per connection.
Wow.
So this money is only going to go half as far as they had hoped, I guess.
You know, Brian, I appreciate your reporting on this, and I'm afraid that we'll have to leave it there and head to a break in the show. But thank you for this. You can find Brian Maffley's story over at sltrib.com. Let's take a quick break, and then we will come back to some more of Brian's reporting. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brian Maffley and news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our live Friday morning Utah News wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting them to @KCPW. Brian Maffley, the town of Tokerville is just off of I-15, about 25 miles from Zion National Park, and they have applied to the Bureau of Land Management to take over some land to build a sort of mega complex. And I think I'll just have you explain to us what that is. What's the plan here, Brian?
Yeah, currently the plan is called the Tokerville Athletic and Recreational Complex. And it would be developed by, you know, a couple private entities. It would also involves a charter school. And what Tokerville is applying for is under the law called the Recreation and Public Purposes Act, where, you know, towns and counties in Utah can petition the Bureau of Land Management to acquire, you know, federal land for some kind of public purpose. And so we've seen this law used many, many times in Utah for pretty straightforward things, you know, a park or a school, place to site a school. You know, Research Park in Salt Lake City was granted to the University of Utah under this act. Okay. That was maybe in the 60s. So, but what Tokerville's doing is quite unprecedented because it's a tiny town. It is expected to grow a lot, but there's maybe 2,000 residents, not quite there. They're expecting really big growth and to, you know, help accommodate that. They'd like to build, partner with some private developers to build this huge complex that really would not serve the residents of Tocqueville, but this influx of tourists that are, you know, pouring into Washington County these days to enjoy its incredible landscapes. And of course, you know, Snow Canyon and Zion Canyon National Park.
Right.
And what they're envisioning is having, you know, this sprawling complex of ball fields so they can host, you know, tournaments, soccer, lacrosse, baseball tournaments, you know, dozens of pickleball courts, an expo center, a beach park with a wave pool and sand. And it's so ambitious. It's mind-boggling
and then
in some ways.
Adjacent to it is a private hotel as well, correct? A sort of luxury
hotel. The developer they are looking to work with is also looking to build this high-end resort on neighboring land that's already private, that kind of is up against the town of Leeds. So this land in question is on the west side of I-15. Tocqueville is on the east side of the freeway. So it's sort of a little bit disconnected from the rest of the town, but there is an exit right there at Anderson Junction. That's the exit you take if you are driving to Zion National Park. And so the thought is, you know, Tocqueville, which doesn't have a single commercial business right now, you know, could, you know, wind up benefiting greatly or, you know, economically from all this tourism traffic that passes right through their town.
And Brian, on the other side of this is a conservation group based in St. George, and they see this as a misuse of that act from the 50s that transfers public amenities, you know, transfers public lands. That allows that kind of transfer of public land for public amenities like parks. You spoke with, I can't remember the name of the group, but Isabel Adler, who's concerned about what this does.
Yeah, the group's called Conserve Southwest Utah, formerly, I think they were called the Citizens for Dixie's Future, but they have raised this concern that it's, you know, having, you know, using public land to, you know, hand over to a private developer to build something that is not really needed for your community is not normally how this law works. And the other part of it is I forgot to mention was they also want to put a charter school that would have, you know, 700 students, you know, on this 600 acres as well. And it's like, what does Tocqueville really need a high school for 700 students? You know, it's a town of, like I said, it was a town of about 1800 now. But this is a charter school that would be for, you know, out of county kids probably. And so their concern is that this is just an effort to privatize public land that is extremely valuable. And here Tocqueville will be able to get it quite cheaply from the federal government and then basically hand it over to a private developer.
Sure.
That said, it's pretty clear that the city of Tocqueville will have to control this project for this to be legal. You can't just, you know, give the land or sell the land or give it to someone else to develop. But I'm a little bit, I'm a little skeptical of this project because so much of it just seems like, you know, it's being driven by pretty, you know, speculative. I don't know how to put this, but, you know, they want to have a park there, schools, ball fields. Those are, of course, those are all public amenities. However, it's going to be run by the private sector, you know, presumably for a profit. The mayor of the town told me, well, his name's Keen Ellsworth, told me, you know, we're not out there to make money. Any money that's raised through this project will be reinvested back into the amenities. You know, I mean, they're doing their best to, you know, turn this into something that's going to benefit the public at large. But at the end of the day, it's going to be a very, it would be a very large tourism-oriented development.
You know, I don't want to, there's more to get through in the show, and I kind of want to march us forward, but you have competing quotes, that is, from this conversation. You've got the, from, you know, the organization, the nonprofit group that is the conservation group, and then also the town's mayor. And I think I'm just going to read them. Isabel Adler with Conserve Southwest Utah says, "The county seems to think that it's better to acquire public lands and continue sprawling out into the resources that draw people here in the first place." The Tocqueville mayor, Keen Ellsworth, says Southern Utah is just getting inundated with growth, just overflowing if we don't approach it head on. In other words, to try to manage that growth, it'll destroy our little city. And maybe I'll bring in Robert Gerke here just for a comment. Robert, news columnist with Salt Lake Tribune. The question that I have here is on that managed growth front, can the growth that they are worried about coming to their community even happen if they don't make it happen?
Yeah, I'm not sure that the proposed project necessarily helps manage the growth. It seems like it would exacerbate some of the growth pressures. But I also am sympathetic to Tocqueville because they, you know, as Brian mentioned, not a commercial business in town. They need some sort of economic, they need an economic bump, and this is common all across rural Utah. Brian, if I could ask you a question, this 600 acres they're looking at, is it environmentally sensitive? Is it what's the nature of this BLM land that they're looking to acquire?
It is just empty desert next to the Red Cliffs, or not next to, but very close to the Red Cliffs National Conservation Area, which was set aside about 15 years ago to protect
the tortoise preserve,
endangered tortoise habitat. But it's extremely buildable land, very accessible to the freeway, and a gorgeous location under the Pine Valley Mountains. I mean, you know, in some ways it, I hate to say this, but it actually kind of makes sense in that this is land that's kind of underutilized right now.
Yeah. Well, and it doesn't do really the public any good to have it sitting there empty. So, you know, I don't personally have as much of a problem with transferring it to Tocqueville for some public use. I share Brian's skepticism about somebody's going to make a lot of money off of this.
Yeah.
And so, you know, let's go about this prudently. Let's try to find a way that it benefits the town without necessarily, you know, lining the pockets of some wealthy developers.
Are there not people who would say that the public benefit is leaving it empty? I mean, you're just thinking of the specific land in question.
I mean, I have not put eyes on this land in particular, but there is a lot of open desert land. And, you know, we hear from the conservatives in the state all the time that the federal government owns 2/3 of the land in the state. You know, I don't necessarily see a problem with conveying some of it to a town for beneficial use that's going to benefit the public generally, you know, rather than just leaving it empty. You know, a big stretch of dirt doesn't necessarily do a whole lot of people a whole lot of good, you know, and maybe it alleviates some of the consternation that people have with the federal government, you know, controlling this much of the land. So, you know, let's play ball a little bit here and see if we can find some net win out of this, but also, you know, let's make sure that they're not just trying to use this as a justification for a couple big money making projects like a big hotel and so forth.
There's quite a bit more to Brian's story, including the history of the developers who are involved in this. And unfortunately, we're gonna have to leave it here, Brian. But I'll remind people to check that out at sltrib.com. Also, remind listeners that you are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. This is your Friday morning Utah News Roundup, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. And Brian, speaking of land transfers, you wrote that state lawmakers have approved the Bears Ears land swap. And this is something that we've talked about before on the show. The idea is to deal with some inholdings inside of the National Monument. I thought that lawmakers were maybe not going to approve this because it would sort of be acknowledging Bears Ears, even when in court they're trying to undermine it. Was that thinking not correct?
Yeah, no, that thinking is still there. That's a lot of the hesitance for the legislature giving approval had to do with the appearance that it would look like they are, you know, signing off on the enlargement of the monument, and that it would be used against Utah in court when, you know, when Utah does go to court to try to undo the monument or undo the action that President Biden took last October to restore the monument. There's reason for that concern, because that's exactly what happened 20 years ago when Utah agreed to swap out of the land, the inholdings in the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. That deal turned out to be a very lucrative one for the Institutional Trust Lands Administration, also, you know, CITLA. And so CITLA would really like to replicate that windfall at Bears Ears. And their argument is, like, whether or not there's a monument at Bears Ears, the agency or the school trust would greatly benefit from that land being traded out for a more, you know, developable land somewhere else. Hmm. And in this case, the legislature on board was they somehow got the BLM to go along with adding more acreage that they're swapping into than they're giving up. So in other words, so there would be a net gain of state trust lands and a net loss of federal lands under this deal.
Wow. What does this particular transfer, I mean, it takes land from, I mean, it puts more land inside of the monument, and then where does the other land get added? Where does the state get a benefit from this?
Yeah, well, the state gets a benefit. Well, not the state, but the school trust gets a benefit, because the land that they're giving up is land largely inside the monument or near the monument, and with a few other parcels over by the Bonneville Salt Flats. It's land that they can't really do much with, and they make about $80,000 a year off this land, mostly on grazing fees. So what they're doing is they're trading this land, it's 160,000 acres, for 165,000 acres spread around 21 counties. Most of it's going to be in San Juan County. Originally, the deal was, you know, not much in San Juan County, but to appease people like Representative Lyman, who's from Blanding, they really bent over backwards to put as much land into this swap in San Juan County as possible. And so this is land, you know, around the town of Blanding, so Blanding can grow. Oil and gas potential up, you know, northeast of Monticello. A lot of land in Emory and Garfield and Grand counties, all land with really great mineral potential, helium, lithium, oil and gas, uranium properties in Garfield County at the old Shearing Canyon site. And then plenty of land in Washington County that has, you know, is pretty valuable for, you know, residential development.
Will this, this deal is final, right? I mean, it's basically going to happen.
Well, yeah. The land targeted in the deal, that is pretty much final. What has to happen now is it needs to get congressional approval. And that means, you know, someone like Senator Lee or Romney is going to have to sponsor legislation to get it authorized on the federal side. But on the state side, it's pretty much sewn up.
Hey, Brian, what about the impact to the lawsuit over Bears Ears, over Biden's re-expanding of Bears Ears to Obama's President Obama's original size? Will this impact that? Do we know?
Well, I think that's an open question. So the, you know, CITLA leadership contends that no, this transaction will have no bearing on the outcome of that lawsuit, which by the way has not been filed yet. But I think if you ask people in the environmental community, I think they'll say they might have a different perspective and say, yeah, this deal is kind of, you know, Utah's signaling its approval of the national monument. Hmm. I mean, I think the argument can go both ways.
Sure.
And we'll see. I will not be surprised if this land deal becomes an issue in that lawsuit.
Okay.
Now, whether or not it affects the outcome, I have no idea.
Right. Robert Gerke, I'm going to bring you in on this because we're kind of low on time. And I guess just as far as the legislature approving this land swap, was that surprising to you?
A little bit, just because there was so much resistance to it before. But I think these are win-win situations for everybody, it feels like. And I wish they would do more of them without necessarily having the complication of a monument, because we've seen the benefits from this. We saw the benefits from the Grand Staircase land swap. We've seen other land swaps go through Washington County and elsewhere where having these scattered sitla parcels doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because they become essentially worthless if they're inaccessible. So let's figure out a way to kind of, you know, put them together and stitch them together into something that can be beneficial for the school kids, beneficial for the communities, and maybe alleviate some of the frustration with the federal government. So I think it's a great idea, and I wish there would be more of them absent a monument.
Brian Maffley, any final comments before we head to a break here?
Yeah, I'd like to say that, you know, Representative Phil Lyman still does not approve of this deal. He's been speaking out against it, even though sitla went to great lengths to accommodate his concerns.
All right. Thanks for that addition. That's Brian Maffley, who is public lands reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, public lands and environment reporter. We're going to take another quick break on the show and then come back with our underplayed stories of the week before we turn to a segment with Leah Larson. Stay with us.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley and Robert Gerke. We will now turn to our final segment in the show, the underplayed stories of the week, just to save time for a recorded segment. And Robert Gerke, have you got a pick ready?
Yeah, I'm going to plug one of my own stories. There was a woman up in Morgan County who had a knock on her door recently, and it was the county was telling her that she had to take down her campaign lawn sign because it was up more than 30 days before the election. And that seemed, you know, the county telling somebody what to do with their private property when they can, you know, exercise this free speech right seemed really counterintuitive to me. I looked into it, and these laws exist in many there in Weber County, Cache County, Clearfield, Moab. All of these cities and counties have these sorts of rules, and the Supreme Court has ruled that they're unconstitutional because they hold campaign signs to a different standard than other signs. So I thought it was an interesting story. Maybe you want to check it out at sltrib.com.
Do check it out. It was interesting. I was actually hoping to have time to talk about it, so I'm glad that you sandwiched that in. Brian Maffley, your pick for underplayed story of the week, if you got one ready.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Blake Apgar has this story about how our municipal public swimming pools this summer might not be open because of extreme staffing shortages. We just can't hire enough teenagers to be lifeguards. That'll be kind of depressing if that's the case.
Yeah. Check that out as well at sltrib.com. I, for my part, will go with another story by Blake Apgar, who's city and county reporter with the Tribune. He reported on the murals here in Salt Lake City depicting people killed by police that went up in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. Now, because of the redevelopment of the Fleet Block, it seems like they're going to be coming down. It's an interesting story, and you can check it out, like everything else that we have been discussing, as I said, over at sltrib.com. And Brian Maffley and Robert Gerke, both that paper, thank you very much for joining me on the show today.
Thanks, Roger. Have a good weekend.
Great.
Yeah, you as well.
Take care, Roger.
You too, Brian. Thanks. Now on the show, we are going to turn to Leah Larson for an update on the Inland Port, among other things. Take a quick listen. Leah Larson, you reported on some additional details emerging about the Utah Inland Port in Salt Lake City's Northwest Quadrant. Some of this reporting came from a meeting between port officials and port opponents. Maybe first just tell us about that meeting and who was at it.
So there were two employees with the Inland Port Authority that were there. One was the director of policy and technology, I think business policy and technology, and he was one who did most of the talking and had most of the interesting tidbits, I would say. But yeah, I guess the coalition had been trying for a while to get a meeting, to get some of their many questions answered. So they set up a 45-minute Zoom call.
And the coalition, we should say, is the Stop the Polluting Port Coalition that has been an ardent opponent of this project since its inception.
Yes, okay. Very vocal opponent.
A few things that seem new out of this meeting are things that I hadn't seen reporting on. But actually, let's start with some of the questions emerging about trains and whether there is a net benefit moving stuff on trains versus trucks in terms of the pollution that's generated. Can you talk about how that was addressed or talked about during this meeting?
Yeah, I'm actually getting yelled at on Twitter right now over this because how dare an article suggest that trains might be more polluting. But if you remember back earlier in the legislative session this year, their lawmakers were kind of upset with Union Pacific because their switcher trains have produced so much pollution. Like one of the largest single point polluters in Salt Lake County. I think in testimony, they said something like they equal like I-15 at rush hour. They produce so much pollution. So trains do pollute. Newer trains are much better, like produce 2010 forward. But at least with the switchers, it doesn't seem until the lawmakers got pretty furious at them that Union Pacific was making any effort to clean up their dirty trains. So to answer your question, yes, one of the questions that the coalition had was, you know, the port keeps touting the fact that they're bringing rails and all this cargo is going to start moving on trains instead of trucks like it is currently, and that is going to reduce pollution. But they pointed out that's not entirely true. Like, it might reduce CO2, which is a big driver of climate change, but in our local airshed, what we're really worried about is like that fine particulate pollution you see during inversions and NOx pollution, and trains do produce a lot of that, at least the older ones do.
Okay. From what I understand in the conversation, port officials basically said, you know, we don't know what's true about which is better or worse, though their feeling was still that trains are preferable to trucks, like the person on Twitter shouting at you, apparently.
Yeah, that's a good summary. Like I said, they were pretty candid. They admitted that there's conflicting information out there, and they don't really know for sure whether the trains will bring more pollution overall. I think the exact line was, we don't think it will, but we'll find out. I hope not, but we'll see, something like that.
Okay. Trains and trucks are meant to be part of the Utah Inland Port's transloading facility, and there's some reporting in your story on that aspect of the Inland Port. Remind us what that transloading facility is, and then tell us why it has hit a snag.
So the transloading facility is sort of the heart of the port. It's going to be the thing that's moving all the cargo from the trains to the trucks and repackaging it and, you know, moving it around. So that's why it's important. And I think all along, because they've located a property directly south of the Union Pacific Intermodal Hub, I think the perception by the public was that they were working in tandem with Union Pacific. Union Pacific is going to be the rail line providing a lot of this freight for the inland port.
Yeah.
And so the port authority thought that they were going to basically have like a direct connection to this intermodal facility owned by Union Pacific and just be zipping cargo back and forth on these little trucks between their transloading facility and the rail yard.
Yeah.
And it sounds like Union Pacific isn't quite on board with that, actually, which I think was quite stunning to a lot of people who were on that call.
Wow. So I guess that the fact that they can't zip between those and the Union Pacific isn't at least right now on board with that plan to some degree. Does that need resolving before the port can continue as it is expected to continue as planned?
It's hard to say because I've never seen like a really good plan of what is intended for this transloading facility. But what they did say is that they'll have to go through the same gate that everybody else uses and circulate it that way. But in my mind, that means there's going to be a lot more traffic, right?
Yeah,
like waiting. A lot less efficient.
Yeah, waiting to get into the Union Pacific's gate there.
Exactly.
Okay, there's also the system of cameras that is in the works. This was something that I hadn't heard about, but it turns out that money has already been spent on this. What are all these cameras for? How many are there? Where would they go? Whose are they?
Yeah, this was interesting to me as well. About 250 cameras is what they said, and they're going to be throughout the Northwest Quadrant. And I guess the idea is this private firm that they've retained is going to help them collect identifying information from vehicles, like vehicle ID numbers, license plates, company logos. And this private company can then turn around and, I guess, use this data to help companies, cargo companies, track where their vehicles are and what their cargo is doing. And then on the state side, they can take the data and help paint a better picture of, you know, the traffic in the inland port and what it's doing, what it looks like. And they say they're going to anonymize the data, but I always get a little nervous when I hear about what's essentially a surveillance system by the state that's being operated by a private company that we don't know a ton about. Just kind of perks up my spidey sense a little bit.
It is interesting. I mean, where would these cameras be placed on roadways? And I guess, would this imply the filming of residents of the Northwest Quadrant as well, in addition to just truck traffic, et cetera?
Yeah, good question. So they asked about that, and it sounds like what he said was, to at least to start, private non-commercial vehicles will be included in this data that they're gathering, but there are plans to scrub them. I don't know how you would even do that, but I'm not a tech professional.
Sure. All of this, for the port opponents is cause for pause, especially the money being spent. And so they want to see a legislative audit. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the Inland Port Authority has a new board. There was kind of a lot of a kerfuffle about that during the legislative session, how they were going to take away basically local representation, like members of the city council, the Salt Lake City Council, West Valley City, Magna, removed them from the board and just basically used a bunch of people with business experience, made a much smaller, more streamlined board. So that board met for the first time earlier this month, and they were the ones who actually floated the idea of a legislative audit, because there were some concerns about how some of the money the legislature is sending them is being spent. And when I spoke with Dita Seed, kind of the leader or the volunteer for the Stop the Polluting Port Coalition, she says that this meeting underscores the need for an audit, just because there's so much we don't know and so much seems to be not working out and just issues with the Port Authority.
All right. This is, again, this is sort of the never ending story. The Inland Port feels that way. Leah, I appreciate you taking the time to tell us about all of this. I'm going to kind of move us forward because I know we don't have you for too long. Yeah, I want to turn now to reporting that you did, Leah, on a proposed dam in northern Utah, Temple Fork, the Temple Fork Dam. Where is Temple Fork and who is proposing this dam and why?
Great question. So Temple Fork is like about 15 miles up Logan Canyon, if you're starting from like Utah State University.
Yeah.
Really popular hiking area, popular fishing area. And the dam that's proposed there is actually part of the Bear River development that is increasingly becoming unpopular, especially as the Great Salt Lake is shrinking. So it's a pretty big dam project that the state has proposed, but this newly formed water district for Cache Valley is proposing like maybe a smaller dam that they could build sooner.
Okay. So a smaller dam that they could build sooner. I tend to think of water from the Bear River development project as being kind of earmarked for growth down here in the Salt Lake Valley and its surroundings, but that sounds like that's not the case for this particular dam, right?
Yes. I think I should probably first underscore that there is not a dam coming in the immediate future. This is just like a high level idea. Like, in order to build this dam, Cache County would need support from the state, and the state is not even thinking about doing a Bear River development project until at least 2050. So there's no impending dam coming. I think you're right. When we think about growth and where the water is needed, a lot of times we think about the highly urbanized Salt Lake Valley, but Cache Valley is growing too. And I guess, unfortunately for them, they were still pretty small when the federal government came in, in the 1950s and built all these large water reclamation projects. Like, I'm in Weber County, so ours would be Pineview and Causey. But they didn't really get that. They have Hiram Dam, which is kind of small, and then Newton Dam. And other than that, a lot of the cities and towns in Cache Valley rely on wells, which have worked out so far. But just last summer, because of this drought, Hyde Park almost ran out of water. Like, it was days away from running out of water. So I think it really caused people to look at, hey, what's our backup? What if with climate change and everything, what if these wells aren't producing anymore? What are we going to do instead? So you can see why there's maybe a preference among some to have a reservoir, especially higher above its population, where it's like a clean source of water. They're not pulling out of like the muddy Bear River. It's clean. It can flow downhill. So I think that's why there's some interest.
Temple Fork is sort of a small river. It feeds the Logan River. The Logan River eventually, I think, joins with the Bear. All of that feeds the Great Salt Lake. And as we know, the Great Salt Lake is drying up. So I imagine there are concerns from people who are worried about water getting to the lake about this proposal, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, getting water to the Great Salt Lake is absolutely critical. But one point that this water manager made was that in the summer, last summer, every single stream and river, including the Logan River, ran dry in Cache Valley. So having a reservoir would maybe help them be able to release water at crucial dry periods to help with in-stream flows. So I think that's another case they're trying to make, like, hey, like, it sounds counterintuitive, but maybe this reservoir could help the Great Salt Lake.
And then many environmentalists, of course, say that a dam is basically always the wrong answer, right? I mean, you spoke with advocates for free-flowing rivers who say no to all dams, basically.
Yeah, I mean, you cannot build a dam and not have environmental impacts. I mean, they've worked really hard at Temple Fork to restore Bonneville trout, cutthroat trout, which is a state fish.
Right.
Back in the 70s, they thought this fish was extinct. And now Temple Fork is one of the few places where this fish thrives. So if you went with the state's plan and flooded this whole Temple Fork area, like bye-bye to all that restoration work, right? It's going to be underwater. And, you know, the trout need like streams to spawn in. They can't spawn in a big reservoir.
Yeah.
But I think that was another case for the smaller scale back reservoir. They could put it above this tributary to the tributary to the tributary. Basically, it's called, I think it's called Spawn Creek. They could put it above that so some of the fish would retain their habitat. But you're right. Like, you cannot build a dam and not have environmental consequences.
And again, just the time frame on this dam proposal, it's something like 50 years out. Is that correct? How about for the rest of the Bear River Development Project dam proposals?
What the state says is right now, there is no need. Like, initially, they thought they would need all this water by 2012. Now they're saying 2050 is the soonest we'll ever need it. And that's for every single dam on the Bear River development, including Temple Fork. Okay. But I am increasingly hearing from water managers that it seems like there's just like no political taste for this. Is it just the public is not like the project maybe might not come at all. There's like no guarantee it's going to come at all.
Wow. That's fascinating. And I want to hear more about that. But you are right now attending the Great Salt Lake Issues Forum, which is put on by the Friends of Great Salt Lake. We talked about the lake drying up. And I just wanted to squeeze in one more of your stories, if that's all right. Dust storms. We've seen more this year already than is normal. That's from exposed lake beds, but not necessarily from the Great Salt Lake yet. Right, Leah?
Right. If you think about the Great Basin is basically a bunch of like prehistoric dried up lakes and then a bunch of modern lakes that are on the verge of drying up, like the Great Salt Lake, like Mono Lake. So yeah, that means a lot of dust. There's a severe dry lake bed down south of Salt Lake Valley, which is has always been a big source of dust up here. But I think the issue with Great Salt Lake is that it's so close to a population center that if it dries up and starts producing dust, we're going to be big, big trouble.
Yeah, and big trouble because of some of what's in the, I mean, we talked about this before, in the lake bed, including, you know, mercury becoming airborne and the health consequences of what that might be. However, you spoke with one researcher from the University of Utah who says that, again, so far, what we're seeing in these dust storms, because we've seen more this year than we have in previous years, is not Great Salt Lake dust. It's from those other dust sources, like you said, drying up lake beds or the West Desert. But he does say that, you know, we're getting close to the Great Salt Lake being the source of these things, right?
Yeah. You know, I think maybe like a lot of people, I've gone out to my car last week and it's covered in like this white film, like this white dust.
Yeah.
And I just assume like it must be coming from the Great Salt Lake. But the whole West is dry right now, right? The whole state, we're in like a pretty severe drought and dry conditions mean dust for us. We're just going to get dust even if we cover the Great Salt Lake with water. So dust is going to be a problem. But yeah, I talked to a University of Utah professor. His name is Kevin Perry. He's kind of like the dust expert.
Yeah.
And he said that right now the lake has 4 active hotspots that are blowing dust. And let's see, one's in like the far northwest corner. One is in Bear River Bay. One is in Farmington Bay. And one is by U.S. Magnesium over in Tooele County. And they are actively producing dust. And, you know, look, those are all pretty close to population centers. So it's like no matter where you live along the Wasatch Front or Tooele County, you're going to get affected by this. But what we're fortunate with right now is there's this thick salt crust that's holding down a lot of the dust. So the whole exposed bed isn't just like pluming dust everywhere. But as that continues to be exposed to the weather and to the elements, it's getting worn down, it's getting eroded, and then eventually the whole lake bed could be a hot, quote unquote, hot spot if we don't get water on that lake.
Wow. And there's a lot of effort towards that. And in fact, part of the show today is talking about a very sort of pie in the sky proposal to bring water from the Pacific Ocean to the Great Salt Lake. As listeners have already heard, Lee Larson is water and land use reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you so much for making the time for this. I know your schedule is busy, so thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for your interest.
Again, that's the Salt Lake Tribune's Leah Larson. Earlier in the show, we also heard from Tribune Public Lands and Environment reporter Brian Maffley and news columnist Robert Gerke. Thank you to all of my guests today. If you appreciate their reporting, I know that I rely on the Trib for reporting on natural resources and the environment and so much more, then consider subscribing to that nonprofit news outlet. You can do that at sltrib.com. If you appreciate this show, you can make a contribution to this nonprofit public radio station over at kcpw.org. And that does it for Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Subscribe to our podcast in your podcast app. I'll just quickly mention, as I see the school kids filing in for a sneak peek here on Library Square in Salt Lake City, that the Living Traditions Festival is getting underway this evening and runs through the weekend. A fun festival and worth checking out, just in case you forgot. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for tuning in for Behind the Headlines. Join us again next week.